We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's B-Y-T-E.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
On the Texas A&M Sports Network, from Learfield IMG College, this is Studio 12, your podcast home for Texas A&M athletics.
Howdy, and welcome to Conversations. I'm Andrew Monaco, and I am joined by Texas A&M basketball coach Jamie McNeely. But we're not going to talk basketball. 15th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And Jamie, a very personal story. First, let's welcome our guest. Howdy, Jamie.
How you doing, Andrew? How's everything?
I'm doing great. I don't know if Mother Nature, God's fate, Hurricane Laura hits on what is the 15th anniversary of Katrina. And for all the stories that we've heard about Katrina and the ramifications and the after effects, Jamie, you were smack dab in the middle of it, weren't you?
Yeah, and a kind of cool part of that, or I'd try to refrain from using cool in the future, but an interesting part of that is I haven't seen Katrina through the eyes of our listeners or through the eyes of you. I haven't watched any news reports. I haven't went back and really looked at footage. I just kind of don't really see a reason to. But yeah, I would say my experience was a little different than I'd say most people, especially people who weren't directly affected by it.
One of the stories at the time was the evacuees, Houston, Dallas. I was in San Antonio at the time, and other cities throughout Texas, and not just Texas related. Jamie, you were not an evacuee. Can you talk about leading up as a student at the University of New Orleans, leading up to Katrina, the thoughts? And then we'll get to where you stay and what happens after that decision.
Yeah, so I could sum up the story quickly before I get into it, but at the end of the day, it's going to be a mama knows best story. And so I'm from Toronto, Canada, as we know, and I was actually home for the summer playing for the university national team. So I was not at summer school. I was in Toronto. I think that year I flew to Thailand over the summer to compete, and just getting back and spending a couple weeks with the family before kind of getting started with the fall semester. And about 2-3 days before I was slated to return, my mom just kind of casually said, "Hey, you know, there's a hurricane coming for New Orleans, and you should probably wait a couple days till after, and then head down to school." And I think, sorry if the days aren't exactly lining up, but I was slated to arrive to campus about 2 or 3 days before Hurricane Katrina. And typical young, naive player that thinks he's invincible. "What are you talking about, Mom? There's hurricane warnings every year in New Orleans. That's where the hurricanes go. We'll be fine. We'll figure out a way." There was actually a hurricane warning the year before. I can't remember the name of it, but me and a teammate actually just right before the hurricane hit, just drove to Atlanta, spent a weekend with his aunt and drove right back. So I actually had some direct experience dealing with that too. So I was already in my mind a pro at dealing with hurricanes, and my mom was, as she should have been, letting me know about a real concern. And so obviously young and dumb, I flew down 100% against my mother's wishes. She was very adamant by the time, even on the way to the airport. And I couldn't grasp what she was trying to say. I had to get to school. I had to start. I had to join the team. And so when we got down, we were hearing the same warnings. And that's all they were. They were warnings, and whatever category it was a day or two before, whatever they were estimating it to be, we thought it was just going to be that. And if it was growing at all, we would go Houston or Atlanta, the same kind of story we did before. And obviously, everyone kind of hanging out and it kind of flipping to whatever it was, Category 4, Category 5, minutes before landfall. Created that panic. And I think the other part that people don't understand, I guess, outside of New Orleans is hurricanes happen and people stay through them and people are fine. And so that was the thought process, I think, for the most part. And so we got to campus. We're hearing the warnings. Our coaches, and I mean, nothing against them looking back, because obviously they didn't know, but they kind of just they got out, they got away. Our head coach went somewhere with his family. The assistants went other places right before it hit. And there was no real plan. Obviously there's a plan now, and I probably, and my team has to go through what we go through for there to be a plan now, but there was none. And so about 6 hours before landfall, I was a junior that year. I called a team meeting in one of our players' rooms. And I said, "Guys, this is not what we thought it was, and we need to figure something out. And what are we doing, and should we do it as a group?" And so, as you would imagine, 17 to 22-year-olds trying to figure out what was going to be one of the worst disasters in U.S. history hours before, we were obviously all too late. And I hear there's a lot of bad imagery around the convention center and the Superdome at the time. And to be honest, that was the first place all of us thought about going. And we just thought that would have been the safest place where all the help was gonna get to. And so we were talking about that a lot. And finally, the group just kind of split it up toward the end of our conversation. And I ended up in a car with four other teammates, heading toward Atlanta. Well, about 20 minutes outside of New Orleans, heading right when you get to the Mississippi border, we realized both ways traffic, all the way clogged up. We're not moving. We're going to end up going through Katrina in this car. Our introvert teammate in the car, obviously it's always the introvert, says, "We're coming up on Picayune, Mississippi," which is literally a half hour, 45 minutes from New Orleans. And my grandmother lives there. And we all kind of have one of those TV look at him weird moments. Like, you could have suggested that a little earlier. So we literally back roaded and arguably went scariest few hours before the hurricane was that team meeting when we realized that we were probably too late. And then finding those back roads to eventually get to Picayune, Mississippi, was not the most fun drive. But we ended up there, and that's where we kind of went through Katrina. And we went through Katrina at my teammate Jacob Manning's grandmother's house, who will forever be a saint in my eyes, because she was easily the warmest person we've been around for that short a time that impacted us that greatly. So
it is one thing to get to Picayune, Mississippi regular, right? You're trying to get there with not just in the weather, Jamie, right? Not just in a hurricane.
That's right.
You still have the nagging "mom told me so" in your mind, don't you?
The whole time, it's a constant recorder, it playing in my brain, and the other variables that kind of hard to capture is gas was already running out, as far as like every other gas station was. Even this is before Katrina hit. Every other gas station, there was no gas left. As it goes from full to three quarter to half, and we made two left turns. And it looks like we're in a bad neighborhood for a while, and the car's shaking a little bit, and the freshman has to make a restroom stop in the worst opportune time. Like, there was just so many little things surrounding that drive, and we didn't even realize the hurricane hasn't even hit yet. The hard part isn't even here yet.
And Hurricane Katrina, yes, the focus was on New Orleans for sure, but the entire Mississippi Gulf Coast was so affected as well, and you are there. So that's leading up to it. Mm-hmm. How was it? You're there, you're safe, you're with his grandmother, but that's not the end of the story, right? You end up becoming isolated, don't you?
Yeah, I call my mom. She's I know every kid says it, but I'm gonna stand by my claim. She's the best mom on earth. And she was so on to the next thing. She understood what was coming. I still didn't know what was coming. And she was just giving me all the advice in the world. And I probably got 100 I love yous. And I was kind of even chuckling during some of it, because again, I didn't know at the time. I called my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife. And during that phone call was the last time I communicated with anyone electronically for 5 days, 6 nights. The phone cut off. So and Andrew, I can't make this up. This is not an exaggeration. This is not for theatrics. The phone cuts off with my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, and we can't put on the TV. It's off. Everyone's phone's dead. We have one radio working, and maybe 2 minutes before it shuts off, it says the hurricane's continuing to move east, and it's looking like the eye is going to pass over. And I kid you not, they say Picayune, Mississippi. And within minutes, the radio is done. There's nothing. So the first thing I notice is it felt like the starting lineup of pitchers at Texas A&M were outside of our house, and it was fastball practice. And I had no idea. What's this sound? I don't get this sound. And sticks, debris, as the wind picked up, it was just stuff hitting the house at ridiculous rates, literally felt like fastballs. I was in a room, a spare room, and I'm nervous to look out of the window because of the speed at which things are hitting the house. I know when I look that one of those sticks or rocks are going to hit that window. And so I was nervous to even look outside. And so that stood out vividly. And then another part of that night that stood out. And that night is a 4-hour conversation. I'm just trying to give you the highlights, I guess, of it. I remember I slept very little. We had a freshman 7-footer from Spain who was literally scared out of his mind, who was my shadow, and just would follow me anywhere I'd walk. I'd walk to get a glass of water, he'd follow me, just because, I mean, we're in it. We're in it right now. And so the fastballs were one big part. And the other part was I go to the grandmother. This is maybe at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. I go to Jake's grandmother. I go, Grandma, why, how can the train still run? How come there's trains still running during the hurricane? I don't understand that. Like, is it that strong? And she's like, no, baby, that's not trains. Those are tornadoes. And Jamie from Toronto that has, like, winters are what I have to face. I have no idea that there's potential for tornadoes inside of hurricanes. And so literally sounds like maybe throughout the night, two or three trains come passing by. House was flooding. We were shoveling stuff out. We were packing everything at the door. Any point of entrance for water, we were just putting anything there. Didn't matter. Electronics, cushions from pillows. Just hopefully we're not one of the places under sea level that's just going to get water. We don't know that at the time. And we weren't, but we were just fighting through that. The next morning, obviously, I didn't sleep. The freshman slept. I don't know how he went to sleep. The next morning, we walk outside, and it's like you couldn't. I wish it was in 2020, so I had a camera phone and I could take pictures, because no one would understand. You couldn't tell where the street was to where the sidewalks were, to where the homes were. It was all kind of mixed together. And three houses down across the street, literally it was the concrete that the house, I guess those houses were built on concrete slabs. It was the concrete of where the house was. And we walk over there and we see literally the path of one of the tornadoes that came pretty close to us. And we see kind of the houses and trees it took down on the way.
I don't mean to be glib here, but it almost sounds like the start of a joke, a Canadian and a Spaniard trying to live through a hurricane.
I would completely agree. And to round it off, we had our 6'8" center, who's a cop in inner city Atlanta. And we have one more play in there, but we had a group, I'd say.
Jamie, you talk about you wish you had a camera, but in your mind's eye, that devastation that you see will always be with you, won't it?
No doubt. And what people, like, it's hard for me to make people understand is we couldn't get out even after. There's literally no streets. There's no streets. There's no sidewalk. There's no houses. There's everything everywhere it's not supposed to be. And so day one, we get into the car with less than half a gas tank, and literally our plan is to drive as north as possible. Any street going north, we're going to drive. And if we see a dead end, we go east or west and go north as possible. And we're all the way on paper maps now. It's a full out deal. Day one, we get about 200 yards away from the house and we turn around kind of laughing, saying it's impossible. And so we go walking. And as far as we can walk and as far as we can see, there's no streets. There's no more streets and no driving around stuff. We had a small SUV. There was no driving on the sides. There's nothing really to drive on. And you know, if you get stuck on the other side of one of these things, getting back to grandma's house is going to be a little more difficult. So we literally played that game for 4 days until day five, we started just, we said, Grandma, we're just going to try to go north. And whatever happens, happens. Obviously, at that point, no cell phones, no contact with the outside world. And about 30, 40 minutes of driving north, we eventually get to a telephone booth that actually works. And there were telephone booths. I'm not that young, Andrew. and the call where my mom cries for literally as long as the call could go on before the guys say, come on, let's go. That call happened and they at least knew I was safe, but they still had no way of ensuring that I would get to where we were eventually going to get to, which was Jackson, Mississippi, and then kind of figure it out from there.
Because for those 4 days, if you can't get out, no one can get in, correct? So you are absolutely isolated, no phone. Your mom, your girlfriend, now wife at the time, they have to be on pins and needles the whole time. You can't communicate with them. You're truly on an island, correct?
That's it. And 2 days into it, everything seems okay. Day three, when the fridge is empty and the frozen meat is already cooked, you immediately begin to see the empathy and compassion from the people in Picayune, Mississippi. We literally walked around and just waited for families to wave us down to come make sure we were well fed and that we were okay. And that's how we ate for two of those days. Those first 2 days, grandma cooked everything she had for us. And we're obviously, we're young athletes, and she didn't do groceries for young athletes. So we ate any and everything she could cook. And then, man, the people of Picayune, Mississippi, whew, like I have to make that pilgrimage one day and just give back to that community, because they literally saved our lives. We wouldn't be who we are today or in the situation we were in that car if those people in Picayune didn't do what they did. And then another random shout out that it's actually just coming to me. I don't think I've shared it, but there was a police officer right outside of Jackson, Mississippi, who we were out of gas. It was past E, and we were flirting with, like, we were just stopping in lines where there was 100 cars and it'd move one car an hour. And it's just like, man, I don't know what to do. I get out the car with Nate, who's the cop in our big man, who's a cop in Atlanta now, who I don't think wanted to be a cop at the time. We walk up to the officer and we just kind of say, hey, man, we're athletes at the University of New Orleans. We have no idea what's going on. We're just trying to get somewhere to where we could communicate with our team and our families. And he brought us to the front of that line and he gave us gas. That changed everything. And everyone that has went through what we went through, there's about 10 of those moments where you rely on someone you don't know. And every time someone stepped up for us. And I think that was one of the most hopeful parts of going through Katrina.
Jamie, what was the decision to go to Jackson? Was it the closest biggest city?
That's exactly right. Make the decision
from there?
And we were just saying maybe Greyhound potentially runs there, because that car, the car actually got salvaged. We left it there, and the teammate who let us use it got it back, and we had to all kind of pitch it and get everything redone and take it out and new everything. But yeah, we split up there. A couple guys waited in Jackson. I took a vigorous bus ride. It was a 48-hour bus ride to Bowling Green, Kentucky, to meet up with the closest person I could meet up with that was familiar to me at all, which was my girlfriend, my wife now, and she was playing ball at Lindsey Wilson. And so the staff there, the people there, it's an NAIA school, small school in Kentucky. Unbelievable. They were unbelievable. So I spent a few days there until we could scrounge up enough money or figure out what was the next step. And then by then, the team was getting contacted, and we had decisions. What are we going to do? And so everyone was up in the air for about a week or two. All the transferring, they were going to let us transfer. They were going to let us not take classes that year. A whole bunch of things they were saying they were going to let us and us, Tulane, a few other schools in the area do. And so we eventually just met up, ironically, in Texas, in Tyler, Texas. UT Tyler, hats off to them. Unbelievably gracious to us. We took classes there. TJC, Tyler Junior College, unbelievably gracious to us. Coach Marquis, who's actually there still right now, amazing coach. He opened his gym up to us. Not only that, he kind of helped us too. He was coaching us, not X's and O's, like kind of just helping us get through stuff. And so, again, just relying heavily on other people. The Phoenix Suns sent a classroom full of gear, electronics for us. I wore a triple XL Bob Marley t-shirt sent by Brian Williams, who was a forward for them the whole year, because I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. But a lot of unique, cool moments of people just kind of reaching out, and we needed it. I'm the last person to ask for help. We needed every ounce of it. Every fast food store we went to, we showed our student ID, they gave us half off. Like, it was just so many people stepping up at that time, and it balances the things like we saw, because there are things we saw that, you know, like we're not going to talk about, like not on this call, just the people in that car. We're just going to keep to ourselves. And there was things we had to do that we kind of just have to keep to ourselves a little bit too, where it's just, you know, it's survival mode, and you have to kind of act on instinct a little bit, and you got to get the job done. And sometimes you got to eat. And if you're eating, it sometimes means other people can eat, if it's survival mode. And we were faced with a lot of little decisions like that. And we still have to be compassionate and think of others, but riddled with little instances like that, where it's a lot of high moments and then a lot of low moments.
When did you eventually get back to the campus, like for good?
Yeah, so we visited campus about a month into being in Tyler. My family didn't have much. My parents are immigrants from the Caribbean and really came up with nothing and made a way for me. So I really had everything I've ever owned with me in New Orleans. Like, I packed up everything I had and just, you know, I wasn't planning on coming back home anytime soon. And so everything was gone, and that wasn't me. That was all the players. We got all the kind of horror stories as we were driving past one of the bridges coming in. One of the players, Wayne Williams, who was a really good player, I actually went to JUCO with him as well, was talking about him and his two-month-old daughter, where they were one of the ones going to the Superdome. And he showed us the bridge where they got stuck on, and with a two-month-old, and it's plus 100 every, like, day and night. It's right. It's too hot at all moments. They were on that bridge for 2 days, and the amount of casualties he said he saw, the amount of things that he had to kind of do to survive as we were crossing that bridge, very surreal, sobering moment that kind of made it real on the way into New Orleans. And I remember, I'll take this with me forever. He said, my daughter saved my life. If we didn't get preferential treatment because we had a 2-month-old daughter, I would have died on this bridge. And like, he's a tough dude, inner city Orlando, and tough dude. For him to kind of break down like that was our first moment back in New Orleans. And then the second semester, I guess we tried to come back on campus. We did. It wasn't held to the highest standard, as you could only imagine. Nothing to the fault of the university. There's just no money to take care of us. And us living in Texas, obviously, is a little more expensive than us on campus. And so nothing against them, but really, really difficult. No fast food, no restaurants. I ate out of a food truck for 4 months out of my life. No groceries. AC spotty, any kind of lighting or electrical spotty at best. Me and one of my teammates, a walk-on, were the only two players to have a full course load during the first and second semester of my junior year of that 2005 year. So, when we got back, it wasn't the University of New Orleans. There wasn't people there. We made the best of it. We had a great time. We probably shouldn't have been back on that campus that early.
Yeah. So your junior year is a year of adjustment, and then senior year is another year of adjustment. That's when Buzz Williams comes in, doesn't he?
Right. And if for everyone that knows Buzz or has had interactions with him, I was an all-conference junior. And I just like my conversation with my mom before Katrina, I had everything figured out. And so I knew at that moment, I'm done with ball. Like I was literally given a second chance. I don't need basketball. I don't need to train every day. I don't need to spend hours. I need to just enjoy my family, enjoy myself, try to find a profession. And I was done. Just graduate. And the day after my last class, fly home and find a 9-to-5. And obviously I didn't insert Buzz into that equation. And the first thing he said to me is how bad of a teammate I am, how selfish I am. This is the first time he's ever seen me. And this was the first team meeting in front of the whole team. And that he doesn't think I last very long because of how selfish I am. And I was just thrown off and confused. And he's like, and his point was, I wasn't with the team during the summer. I was with the national team, and I wasn't doing a good job of keeping in contact with them. So I responded the way you think I'd respond, Andrew. I shrugged them off and said, screw this guy. I'm finishing this year out, and I'm going home, and I'm starting to work. I'm not going to play this game with this guy. And just kept coming at me every single day, relentless, nonstop. And I finally made a decision. I'm like, well, I know I can be what he's asking me to be. I know that. It's, do I want to do it? And is he going to stop, or is he just going to keep on asking me to be the best I could be in every facet, every single day? And so I just gave in a few weeks of that. And I said, all right, let me see. And we quickly took to each other. And that's kind of, I think I had to be at that point in my life to kind of gravitate toward Coach Buzz the way I did. Just because he needs someone malleable, especially in that situation. And when I decided to give in, I think I kind of became that, and he kind of groomed me to have a season that I'll never forget, that kind of catapulted me into my career.
Jamie, would freshman Jamie McNeely have just walked away?
Freshman Jamie would have 100% walked away, and might have tried to fight him a few times. No doubt about it. Those experiences, and that's the beauty, and that's the beauty of this climate. We could all have differing opinions of what's going on, but we know this. We're going to come out of this on the other end a little different. Whether it's more compassion, less compassion, whether it's how we go about our daily routine, that changes. And I think I've kind of been through that, and I described it to Coach a few times. This feels like a long version, long, drawn-out, slow-played version of Katrina. Katrina was a lot of highs, a lot of lows, just intense in a short amount of time. But the feeling I felt is very similar in that there's just a lot of uncertainty, a lot of not knowing what's going on, and their compassion needs to turn up because I need to be who that officer was to me, who Jake's grandmother was to me. During times like this, because I mean, they got me through it. And so credit to Buzz for, and I think some of it was just, he was so young and he wanted to be successful so bad. And he saw that I'm a rising senior, and he kind of needed me to be that. And it just kind of worked out that way. Like you're saying, like me a year ago would have probably not taken to him before Katrina. So,
The reason why I ask that, whether it's Buzz, grandmother, cop, people come into our lives, we don't know why, ultimately, but they come at the right time, don't they?
I couldn't agree more. And I think one thing I've learned is you got to ask for help. And the other thing I learned is when someone's asking for help, you really got to listen. And I think that's what was happening. That cop didn't say, screw you, a couple kids. And full disclosure, the cop was not an African-American. And it's a car full outside of the big man, full of African-Americans. And that was a non-issue at that point in time. The only issue was there's a couple of athletes that are lost right now. They're not with their parents. They're not with their team. And he saw that. He didn't see a bunch of young athletes that probably are going to be fine no matter what. And I think that lesson is ingrained and etched, and it changed me. I became so much more compassionate and understanding at that point. And in times like this, and especially even all the social unrest, it's time to step up the compassion and listen and apply what people are trying to say to us relative to, hey, I need help, or I'm in trouble, or something's not right with me right now.
It changes you, not just as a coach, because now you're in that position, right to affect others,
right?
Also as a father, correct? And a husband?
That I couldn't agree more. Like literally my son, like he has no idea what's going on. And the lessons I'm giving my 3-year-old are probably lessons that 8-year old should get. But by the time he's 8, he's gonna get it. And I wouldn't be the father I am. I wouldn't be the husband I am. And by no means am I saying I'm the prototypical husband or father, but those, I think back to Katrina and lessons I've learned weekly. And when I say think back, it's not just kind of, oh man, that was weird. Or no, really taking an interaction I had and going, wow, like how amazing was that? How much did that person step up for me that I took for granted at that time?
The other thing that hits me is since you've been with Buzz, you've never worked 9 to 5, right? There's no such thing as 9 to 5 with Coach, is there?
No, it's your life. It's a way of life. Even when I try to explain it to some other coaches and the coaches that have worked for him that have moved on, I think describe it best, but it's different. It's different. It's a different way to do it. It's unique. It's not how everyone else goes about it. And in that, I mean, it takes everything out of you to make sure all of our guys are as prepared as they need to be to play the way we kind of finished the year and to play with that kind of intensity and that kind of edge. And that's nonstop. And even more so in trying to find the next one, because our pool of kids that we can recruit is a lot smaller than typical schools because of the demand we're asking. And not to take anything away from playing for him, it takes every ounce of being to play for him too. But in the end, and I think I'm living proof of it, it pays dividends, and the dividends don't end because it becomes who you are as a worker, who you are as a person, when you learn how to work at that intensity and when you figure out how to kind of bust through barriers. And I think that's what Coach Buzz specializes in.
And Jamie, you are there as well for the student athletes. They can go to you. You have lived what they are going through with Coach, correct?
100%. They know that. There's other people on staff that have also been in similar shoes as myself, have played for Coach and that are on staff. I think it's a necessity. Because we're not asking them to, hey, come, let's get some conditioning, let's run some plays and win a game. We're asking them for so much more than that. And when they hear it from someone who has literally lived through it, and I'll always say the toughest year to play for Buzz was his first year. I don't care what no one says. But that's daily conversations. Hey, when you played for Coach, .. It's like, whoa, okay, right. And you get those enough to where – you see the value in it. You see where the players need that kind of reassurance. Like there's light on the other end while they're grinding and working so hard. And it's like, yeah, there's light. The light's going to be, you're going to win a bunch of games, and the other light's going to be, you're going to be a tougher human being, and you're going to be able to handle situations better for the rest of your life.
You lived one of the most, I don't know if traumatic is the right word, but what a life lesson for you as a junior.
Yeah.
To go through that. But the impact, I don't want to say immeasurable, Jamie, because it is measurable. As you said, it's how you are compassionate with people, the way you understand that. But I don't know if there could have been a more powerful experience for you to go through. You hate it at the time, but it really shapes who you are now, doesn't it?
No doubt. And when I talk to my old teammates about it, and we kind of reflect on it from time to time, we always come back to, we had no idea, even during Katrina, what was going on, the magnitude, the billions of dollars that it would cause in damages, the hundreds or thousands of families that have been relocated to Texas and Georgia and just other places permanently. We had no idea. And I think the beauty of it was there was some level of camaraderie or teamwork that got us through it. And what a lesson to learn for a basketball team. You want to go through a boot camp or individual sessions to grow closer. Try going through Katrina with 4 teammates in a undersized, small SUV and in a 2-bedroom bungalow in the middle of nowhere in Mississippi. You grow close. And I think that year we didn't win a bunch of games, We had six players, and three of them were kind of checked out mentally, and it was a messy year per se. But I would say the teams that went up against us felt something different. Our fight was a little different. It was a little more personal. We had a little more to get off our shoulders during games, and I think that kind of camaraderie and that teamwork, ironically enough, is it was the biggest variable in kind of helping us through it before, during, and even after. Because the part you alluded to a little bit, Andrew, that I think we're going to have to deal with a lot just in general moving forward, not just with our team, just the mental health of our guys. You know, Katrina made me depressed. Katrina made me want to give up basketball. I was giving up basketball. Katrina made me want to not to move and not live in the States anymore. Like, there were so many things where I was convinced and I needed people to talk to me. I needed that community. I needed that team camaraderie to kind of push me through it.
We talk in being in the world of athletics about players being in the moment, about trusting one another. That happened off the court, right? And you know, for people who don't get athletics, they think it's always a stretch. I've never thought it's been a stretch that, like you said, Buzz and Jimbo Fisher, great at it. Pat Henry's great at it. Gary Blair's great. The coaches at Texas A&M are so good about life lessons, not just team lessons, sport lessons that they coach, but being life lessons. That becomes more important. But that athletic part of it, by you being an athlete, and Jamie, maybe it was good you guys had no idea what you were going through. Maybe that helped. But that's where the lessons of athletics come in, that you're in Picayune, Mississippi, and you are in that moment. You can't control anything else. You can't control the billions in damage and all that. In that moment, that's when the lessons of being an athlete pay off for everybody, because now it's time to trust, it's time to communicate, it's time to, you can even disagree, right? But that's when it comes together, doesn't it?
That I couldn't agree more, Andrew. And just a testament to that is, throughout the whole deal, we use basketball terminology. That's just how we spoke. Hey, what's the scouting report here? What's the game plan? Hey, what's the strategy with this? Man, the hurricane's coming. Like, how are we going to defend against it? That's how we were, like, kind of talking. And it wasn't like I'm exaggerating a little bit. But no, I remember talking in that meeting we had with our team before Katrina hit while we were in New Orleans. We were talking about, like, what's the scouting report? What's the game plan? How are we going to stick together? Who should stick together? What freshman should go with what senior? Two players said, I'm out of here. I'm going to the Superdome. And they literally went to the Superdome and went through what everyone went through out there. And so, like, the camaraderie, the team aspect, the referring back to the lessons you learned, you never realize it. And it's obviously, we're older now and we understand, but even our current players, they don't understand the words we keep saying to them aren't for them to score more points right now. It's for when their Katrina happens, they have something to refer back to that's going to help them get through it. And that's how we explain things to them. And Coach Buzz takes his time with that and make sure that they understand, to the point where guys can even get frustrated with the lessons. And that, insert Coach Jamie. Yeah, be as frustrated as you want. And sometimes you're going to have to listen to lessons you already know, but it's not for you to ignore right now. It's for you to get it etched in your brain, and that's what we're trying to do. And me having gone through it as a player, especially under Coach, they get that. They understand what I'm saying isn't from a coach, it's from a former player.
Jamie McNeely, thank you so much for sharing your story. Always, you know, I love spending time with you. Even
it's a pleasure,
if it's about hurricanes or whether it's about basketball, it's always a pleasure, my friend.
That's it. You make it easier for me to talk, Andrew. So I appreciate it. I'll tell Evan, no more interviews with anyone else except for you.
I get the exclusive. Yes.
Might not be worth much, but.
Jamie, thank you again.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you having me on.